The next subheading in this chapter is point number C, four Elizabethan dramatists. The essay Four Elizabethan Dramatists was written in 1924 to form the preface to a projected book on Webster, Turner, Middleton and Chapman. However, the book was never written. But the essay is significant, for in it we find the main tenets of his dramatic criticism. Eliot points out that in Charles Lamb's dramatic criticism, we have the origin of deplorable separation of drama from poetry and of drama from literature. Lamb praised the poetic qualities of Elizabethan plays but criticized them for their failure on the stage. Thus arose the opinion that drama and poetry are two separate things, while in reality they are the two aspects of one and the same thing. As he tells us elsewhere, at its highest moment all drama tends to be poetic and all poetry dramatic. Similarly, William Archer and Swinburne have given currency to the view that drama and literature are two separate things. In the opinion of Eliot, the dramatic element and the literary element are integral to a play and cannot be separated. William Archer further points out that the great fault of Elizabethan drama is its lack of realism. In this respect, modern drama is far superior to the Elizabethan. Eliot does not agree with this view. In his opinion, the one great fault of Elizabethan drama is its lack of suitable artistic conventions. This is also the fault of modern drama. It is essential that there should be suitable dramatic conventions and the playwrights should work within those conventions. The Greek drama had such conventions and hence its superiority. The great weakness of Elizabethan drama is not its lack of realism but its attempt at realism, not its conventions but its lack of conventions. The Elizabethans had no firm idea of what they aimed at. They had certain unrealistic conventions, as for example the surly Loki, the Aeschide and the ghost. Such contentions are neither ridiculous nor bad in themselves. They become bad when working within these conventions the dramatist aims at realism. It is this attempt at realism which spoils many a good Elizabethan play. As a matter of fact, there has been too much of realism in the English drama. There is no doubt that for a work of art, on the one hand, actual life is the material and on the other hand, an abstraction from actual life is a necessary condition to the creation of a work of art. There can be no photographic realism in a play. No complete and faithful mirroring of life. A great work of art arises only when the artist consciously sets a limit to realism. Art imposes form and pattern upon reality, and this means withdrawal from life. Art has its own laws, and a strictly realistic drama is a kind of escape from the conditions and limitations of art. Only poetic drama can be artistic. Realistic prose drama is a bad art. In other words, Eliot is opposed to realism in the themes of drama. Drama must take its themes from life, but they must be artistically treated. There should be an artistic ordering and selecting of material. Thus, the essay gives a full and clear exposition of Eliot's artistic principles. Then, point D and next subheading, the possibility of poetic drama. There is no poetic drama in the modern age. Even when poetic plays are written, they are not successful on the stage. They can be read, but they cannot be acted. They are insipid and academic. When people are asked the reason for the failure of poetic drama in the modern age, it is pointed out that conditions are not favorable for the flourishing of poetic drama. Conditions of life have changed, and there are other forms of literature to divert the attention of the people. But T.S. Eliot does not agree with these views. In his opinion, poetic drama is possible in the modern age. Charles Lamb separated drama from poetry and pointed out that the poetic plays of Shakespeare cannot be staged. Such separation of poetry and drama is wrong and unhealthy in its influence. In Eliot's opinion, there can be no separation of poetry and drama, for drama is only one among several forms of poetry. Drama is simply a form of poetry and not a separate genre. It is the most permanent form of poetry. It is capable of greater variety than any other poetic kind. It was entirely because of the immense expressive powers of dramatic poetry that the Elizabethans could express such varied and novel thoughts and images. Consequently, the blank words of their plays accomplished a subtlety and consciousness, even an intellectual power that no blank words since has developed or repeated. Attempts were made by Wordsworth and Browning to hammer out new forms for themselves, but they were not successful. Shakespeare developed the blank words to the maximum possible extent, and so, to be successful, a modern dramatist must avoid echoing Shakespeare in his dramatic words. Permanent literature, according to Eliot, is always a presentation, either a presentation of thought or a presentation of feeling, through events, actions, and objects of the external world. In the greatest literature, as in the dialogues of Plato, there is a representation both of thought and feeling. Both such fusion is very difficult. But such fusion is very difficult. That is why Eliot points out modern poetic drama must avoid the propagation of any philosophy. It must concentrate on feeling. It may deal with contemporary problems, but this should be done in an unobstructive manner. Drama is primarily an entertainment, and the poetic drama can become popular only if it aims at entertaining the people. Up till now, the majority of attempts at poetic drama have begun at wrong end. The dramatists have aimed at the small audience which wants poetry. Poetic drama can be possible in the modern age only if the dramatists take it as a form of entertainment and subject it to the process which will leave it a form of art. If the drama really entertains, the audience will extend a lot of poetry that may have been put in it. Then the point E, poetry and drama. Poetry and drama is a lecture delivered by the poet in 1950 at Harvard University. Not only is it a complete statement of Eliot's theory of poetic drama, it also throws valuable light on his own dramatic practice. He has constantly talked and written about drama and dramatists, and in this lecture he reviews, expounds, and analyses his earlier opinions. Eliot always advocated a revival of poetic drama in the modern age, for he was convinced that poetic drama can offer much more to the playgoers than prose drama. Poetry should not be used as a mere decoration to the drama. It should justify itself dramatically. No play should be written in words for which prose is dramatically adequate. It should not merely be fine poetry shaped in a dramatic form. Poetry which merely gives pleasure to a cultured few is superfluous and is to be avoided. It is generally objected that the use of words in drama is artificial, but prose used on the stage is equally artificial. The prose which the characters on the stage speak is as remote in vocabulary, syntax, and rhythm from ordinary speech as words is. Eliot distinguishes between prose, words, and ordinary speech and points out that daily speech is much below the level of either words or prose. Dramatic prose is as artificial as verse, and conversely, a verse can be as natural as prose. The audience, when it hears prose spoken on the stage, does not regard it as different from the ordinary speech. On the contrary, when verse is used, it approaches the play with a consciousness of such difference. In other words, it is prepared to enjoy the play and the language of the play as two separate things. This is deplorable, for the effect and enjoyment of dramatic speech should be unconscious. It is for this reason that the mixture of prose and verse in the same play must be avoided. The transition makes the auditor aware with a jolt of the medium. Such a mixture might have been acceptable in the Elizabethan age, but it must be avoided in the modern age. Today, there is a prejudice against poetic drama, and so prose should be used very sparingly. Words should be made sufficiently elastic to express every situation and every scene. And if they are proved to be scenes which cannot be put in words, we must either develop our words and avoid having to introduce such scenes. Prose should be avoided so that the audience may grow accustomed to words and cease to be conscious of it. It will be poetry only when the dramatic situation has reached such a point of intensity that poetry becomes the natural utterance, because then it is the only language in which the emotions can be expressed at all. There is another reason also why prose should not be used in the modern poetic drama. Words should be used throughout so that the words' rhythm should have its effect upon the hearers without their being conscious of it. The opening scene of Hamlet is the perfect example of the use of words in the drama. Nothing is superfluous, and there is no line of poetry which is not justified by its dramatic value. The use of words here has dramatic inevitability. Moreover, the audience is not conscious throughout the scene of the medium, whether it is listening to prose or words. Thirdly, the verse is transparent. The audience is consciously attending not to the poetry but to the meaning of the poetry. It is great poetry, it is dramatic, and it also has a musical design which intensifies the emotional effect of the scene. The use of words in drama is not a mere decoration, it intensifies the drama. The effect of such words is unconscious and it affects even those who do not like poetry. The use of words in drama is not a mere decoration, it intensifies the drama. The effect of such words is unconscious and it affects even those who do not like poetry. Eliot then refers to plays which are in reality poetic, even though they are written in prose. The plays of Sins and Maeterlinck are such plays, but the scope of poetic plays in prose is a limited one. The poetic drama in prose is more limited by poetic convention or by our conventions as to what subject matter is poetic than is the poetic drama in verse. A really dramatic verse can be employed to say the most matter of the fact things. In the second part of the lecture, Eliot examines his own practice of poetic drama. When he took to writing plays, he realized that the experience he had gained in writing poetry will not be of much help to him. The problem of communication is not so urgent in poetry as it is in poetic drama. The dramatist writes with the immediate object of influencing an unknown and unprepared audience, and what he writes would be interpreted by unknown actors guided by unknown producers. Therefore, the artist has to practice great self-control and always keep in mind the law of dramatic effectiveness. Therefore, in his own practice, he tried to solve this problem of communication and succeeded in doing so in The Cocktail Party, a play of modern life. The family reunion is defective because it has poetic passages which are not justified dramatically, and secondly, there is no proper adjustment between the Greek story and the modern situation. He practiced full artistic self-restraint and avoided using poetry which was not dramatically justified with such success that it has been doubted whether there is any poetry at all. He used in it the dramatic device of suspense. It is the unexpected which frequently happens. He has already worked out in the earlier plays a proper idiom and a proper versification which could serve all purposes without recourse to prose. He had subjected himself to a long period of self-education, and in this play he put his poetry on a very thin diet in order to adapt it to all the needs of the stage. His own practice as a words dramatist was conceived him that good poetic plays come from poets learning to write plays, then from prose dramatists learning to write poetry. In the modern age, verse drama will become acceptable only when it comes from the pen of those who have already acquired a reputation as poets. Poetic drama is an ideal which is unattainable. Constant exploration and experimentation is necessary for closer and closer approximation to this ideal. There is a fringe of indefinite feelings which cannot be expressed by a prose dramatist. These feelings can be expressed only in poetic drama at its moments of greatest intensity. At such moments, dramatic poetry approximates to music. It imposes order on human actions and feelings, and this design or order in both of poetry and music. Poetic drama brings us to a condition of serenity, stillness and reconciliation by imposing order upon reality in such a way that we are aware of an order in reality. Then point F, a critical review of Eliot's views on poetic drama. Eliot's dramatic criticism has both a negative and a positive aspect. Negatively, he seeks to demolish the concept of superiority of naturalistic prose drama which held the day, and positively he asserts the need and the possibility of poetic drama in the modern age. In his view, the real opposition or antithesis is not between poetic drama and prose drama, for there can be poetic drama written in prose. The real antithesis is between poetic drama and realistic drama. It is erroneous to separate drama and poetry. As a matter of fact, poetry and drama are inseparable. Poetry is the natural language of man in moments of highest emotional excitement, and therefore, at its highest moments, drama would grow poetic. It does so in the hands of skilled dramatists like Shakespeare. The poetry used in drama must be dramatically inevitable. It must seem to flow out of character and action, and should intensify both character and action. No poetry should be introduced which is not dramatically justified. Words should not be a mere embellishment, a mere superfluity. Such fusion of poetry and drama must be the ideal which the verse dramatist should constantly keep before him. It has been said that prose is the natural medium of expression and poetry is artificial and unnatural. But the use of prose for dramatic dialogue is also artificial. It is as much removed from the language of daily use as words. Moreover, the use of a colloquial style and idiom is likely to grow monotonous, for it can never express the variety of emotions and situations which a dramatist has to depict. Rhetoric, for these reasons, has its place in poetic drama. Moreover, the naturalistic prose drama deals with the superficial and the ephemeral in situation and emotion. Verse drama, on the other hand, expresses the permanent and the universal. It is also wrong to say that verse tends to limit the range of emotions. As a matter of fact, the emotional range is increased by the use of verse. Just as Eliot opposes realism in the language and the diction of drama, so also he opposes realism in its theme. He lays down the sound artistic principle that through, on the one hand, actual life is always the material, on the other hand, an abstraction from actual life is necessary condition to the creation of a work of art. The artist must order and select his material. He must impose form and order upon reality to make apparent its hidden meaning and significance. There can be no photographic realism in art. The drama which seeks to portray the problems of real life cannot be regarded as a great work of art. Poetic drama may use contemporary material, but in so doing, it must order and shift its material. It should deal with these vague and indefinite feelings which cannot be expressed by prose drama, but which are real and actual all the same. Eliot asserts that poetic drama is possible in the modern age, but the age is complex and the verse dramatist will have to face complex problems before he can succeed. The one crucial problem is that of a suitable dramatic convention. The real defect of Elizabethan dramatists is not that they lacked realism, but that there was too much realism. Their conventions were poetic and unreal. The ghost, the soliloquy, the aside, etc. But they had no definite convention regarding the aims of drama. Their fault was the working within their poetic conventions. They aimed at realism, and the result was fantastic and absurd. So in the modern age, suitable conventions must be developed. The words dramatists must be clear about their aims. It must be remembered that drama had its origin in church liturgy. The Mass is the most perfect kind of drama. This should never be forgotten. The aims of poetic drama can never be purely secular. They must be ethical and religious as well. Eliot commends the artistic convention of three unities, for they impose form and order and result in greater intensity. Similarly, the use of words imparts intensity as well as imposes form and order on poetic reality. Besides developing suitable artistic and religious and ethical conventions, the dramatist must also develop a suitable words form. The problem of a suitable medium of communication is a difficult one, for the dramatist has to communicate to an unknown audience and is interpreted by an unknown actor. The use of traditional blank verse should be avoided, as it has grown rigid after its long use for non-dramatic purposes. A more flexible verse form, capable of expressing a wider range of emotions, must be developed. Themes and characters must be contemporary and colloquial, idiom and style, the language of daily life, with proper selection and modifications must be used. It is a wrong notion that only mythological subjects and a remote, archaic style are suited to poetic drama. The style must preserve an illusion of natural speech, but in fact it should be heightened and remote. There is a fringe of vague, indefinite feelings which cannot be expressed by prose dramatists, but which are real and actual. They are expressed by the words dramatist at moments of highest dramatic intensity. As the contemporary audiences have been conditioned to prose drama, poetic drama would become acceptable only when it comes from the pen of those who have already made their marks as poet. Poetic drama imposes form and order on human actions and feelings, and makes us conscious of an order in reality. In other words, at moments of highest intensity, it makes us see into the heart of things and show results in serenity and spiritual calm. Poetic drama is an ideal and an unattainable ideal, but a greater and greater approximation to this ideal is possible. And with this end in view, the dramatist must carry on constant experimentation and exploration. Thus, Eliot has a well-reasoned theory regarding the nature, function, and possibility of poetic drama in the modern age. His own effort as a dramatist was to put his theory into practice and thus to bring about a revival of poetic drama. He may not be a great dramatist, but his dramatic theory and practice had corrected many a wrong notion about poetic drama, exercised a wide influence, and did much to stimulate interest in poetic drama. The next subheading of this chapter is a general estimate of T.S. Eliot as a critic, his limitations, his achievement and contribution, his greatness. A great poet critic, Eliot is one of the long line of poet critics extending from Sir Philip Sidney to our own day and including such names as Ben Jonson, Dryden Johnson, Wordsworth, Coleridge and Arnold. Both from the point of view of the bulk and quality of his critical writings, Eliot is one of the greatest of literary critics of England. His 500 and odd essays published as reviews and articles from time to time have had a far-reaching influence on the course of literary criticism in the country. Eliot made English criticism look different, says George Watson, though not in a simple sense. His criticism has been revolutionary. He has turned the critical tradition of whole English-speaking world upside down. The Sacred Wood was published in 1920, and since then his authority has steadily increased. I cannot think, say John Howard, of a critic who has been more widely read and discussed in his own lifetime, and not only in English, but in almost every language except Russian throughout the civilized world. Then some limitations. As a critic, Eliot has his faults, and some of them are quite glaring ones. Sometimes he pontifically assumes a hanging judge attitude, and instead of sympathetic understanding, his pronouncements shiver off a verdict. Often his criticism is marred by personal and religious prejudices, and dislike of a man comes in the way of an honest and impartial estimate. In this respect, he does not live up to his own theory of the objectivity and impersonality of poetry. His condemnation of Milton and that of Shelley can hardly be called sound literary criticism. When he scoffs at Arnold for his being an overworked inspector of schools, he drifts away from criticism proper and stoops to personal invective. Moreover, he does not judge all by the same standards of criticism. For example, in his essay on Dante, he remarks that knowledge of the ideas and beliefs of a poet are not essential for an appreciation of his poetry, but he condemns Shelley for his repellent ideas. There is an element of didacticism in his later essays, and with the passing of time, his critical faculties were more and more exercised in social problems. Critics have also found fault with his style as too full of doubts, reservations, and qualifications. Then, the next subheading is his contribution. A. Reassessment of earlier writers. However, such faults do not detract from Eliot's greatness as a critic. His criticism offers both a reaction and reassessment. Through his practical criticism, he has brought about a revolution of the great literary names of the past three centuries. His recognition of the greatness of Donne and the other metaphysical poets of 17th century has resulted in the metaphysical revival of the 20th century. The credit for the renewal of interest in the metaphysicals and the Jacobean dramatist must go to Eliot, and Eliot alone. Similarly, he has resorted Dryden and the other Augustan poets to their rightful place in the hierarchy of the English man of letters. According to Brad Brook, his essay on Dante resulted not only in a greater appreciation of the Italian poet, it aroused keen curiosity and enthusiasm for the later Middle Ages. We may not sometimes agree with his views, but there can be little doubt that he is highly original and tough-provoking. The novelty of his statements, couched in trenchant phrases, startles and arrests attention. He has shed new light on a number of English writers and has made them look entirely different. According to Eliot, the end of criticism is to bring about a readjustment between the old and the new, and his own criticism performs this function to a nicety. He says, from time to time, it is desirable that some critic shall appear to review the past of our literature and set the poets and the poems in a new order. Such critics are rare, for they must possess, in addition to an unusual capacity for judgment and independence of mind powerful enough to recognize and interpret for their generation its own values and categories of appreciation. Matthew Arnold was such a critic, as were Coleridge and Johnson and Dryden before him, and such in our day is Eliot himself, John Hayward. Eliot's re-estimation of the dramatists and poets of the 17th century remains unrivaled in the history of English criticism. Then the next heading is, provided a corrective to Romanticism. Eliot's practical criticism offers a reassessment of earlier writers. His theoretical criticism represents a reaction to Romantic and Victorian critical credo. He called himself a classicist in literature, and one of his important contributions is the reaction against Romanticism and Humanism, which he strengthened. The reaction had been started by T. E. Halme. Eliot carried it on, made it a force in literature, and thus brought about a classical revival both in art and criticism. He rejected the romantic view of the perfectibility of the individual, stressed the doctrine of the original sin, and exposed the hollowness of the romantic faith in the inner voice as merely doing what one likes. He stressed that a critic must follow objective standards. Instead of following merely his inner voice, he must conform to tradition. A sense of tradition, a respect for order and authority, is at the core of Eliot's classicism. And in this respect, the essay, Tradition and Individual Talent, is the manifesto of his critical creed. In this way, his criticism is a corrective to the eccentricity and waywardness of the contemporary impressionistic school of criticism. Similarly, he sought to correct the excesses of what he contemptuously called the abstract and intellectual school of criticism represented by Arnold. The critic must have a highly developed sense of fact, and he must judge on the basis of these facts with perfect detachment and impartiality. He thus sought to raise criticism to the level of science. In his objectivity and scientific attitude, Eliot is the English critic who most closely resembles Aristotle. In this stress on facts, on comparison and analysis, Eliot has exercised a profound influence on the new critics. He has started many new trends in English criticism. Then next subheading, revolutionary theory of poetry. Eliot's theory of impersonality of poetry, says A.Z. George, is the greatest theory on the nature of the poetic process after Wordsworth's romantic conception of poetry. According to the Romantics, poetry was an expression of the emotions, the personality of the poet. Thus, Wordsworth said, expression of the emotions, the personality of the poet. Thus, Wordsworth said that poetry was an overflow of powerful emotions, and that it had its origins in emotions recollected in tranquility. Eliot rejects romantic subjectivism and propounds the revolutionary doctrine that poetry is not a letting loose of emotion, but an escape from an emotion. Not an expression of personality, but an escape from personality. The poet is merely a catalytic agent in the presence of which varied emotions fuse to form new wholes. He differentiates between the emotions of the poet and the artistic emotion, and points out that the function of criticism is to turn attention from the poet to his poetry. Thus, his criticism is a corrective to the excesses of the biographical, historical, and sociological schools of criticism. He thus changed the entire course of critical theory and practice in many ways of far-reaching significance. Then, next subheading and point D. New light on the poetic process. Eliot's views on the nature of poetic process are equally revolutionary. According to him, poetry is not inspiration, it is organization. The poet's mind is like a receptacle in which are stored a number of varied feelings, emotions, and experiences. The poetic process is the process of fusing these disparate experiences and emotions into new wholes. In his essays on the metaphysical poets, he writes, "When a poet's mind is perfectly equipped for its work, it is constantly amalgamating disparate experiences. The ordinary man's experience is chaotic, irregular, fragmentary, but in the mind of the poet, varied experiences are always forming new wholes. Perfect poetry results when, instead of dissociation of sensibility, there is unification of sensibility. The emotional and the intellectual, the creative and the critical faculties must work in harmony to produce a really great work of art." Up till now, critics had either stressed that the aim of poetry is to give pleasure and in this way to mitigate pain, or that its function is moral edification. A great poet both instructs and delights. However, for the Eliot, the greatness of a poem is tested not by the pleasure it gives or the moral elevation it leads to, but by the order and unity it imposes on the chaotic and disparate experiences of the poet. Wimstead and Brooks are therefore right in saying, hardly since the 17th century had critical writing in English so resolutely transposed poetic theory from the excess of pleasure versus pain to that of unity versus multiplicity. In this way, Eliot's theory of poetry marks a break from tradition and gives a new direction to literary criticism. Then the next subheading and point E. Formulation of new concepts. Eliot has formulated a number of new critical concepts, which, thanks to his gifts of phrasing, has gained wide currency and exercised a far-reaching influence on criticism ever since. Objective correlative, dissociation of sensibility, unification of sensibility are only a few of the Eliot's cliches which have been hotly debated by a host of critics and have made people sit up and think. His dynamic theory of tradition, his theory of impersonality of poetry, his insistence on a highly developed sense of fact on the part of the critic have all tended to impart to literary criticism both catholicity and rationalism. Then the last subheading is Eliot's influence. To conclude, Eliot's influence as a critic has been wide and all-pervasive. It has also been a continuing one. He has corrected and educated the taste of his readers and has brought about a rethinking regarding the function of poetry and the nature of the poet process. He gave a new orientation, new critical ideas, and new tools of criticism. It is in the reconsideration and revitalization of English poetry of the past that his influence as a critic has been most fruitful and inspiring. No critic, indeed, since Coleridge has shown more clarity. No critic, indeed, since Coleridge has shown more clearly the use of poetry and of criticism. Estimating the achievement of Eliot as a critic, George Watson writes, Eliot made English criticism look different, but not in a simple sense. He offered it a new range of rhetorical possibilities, confirmed it in its increasing contempt for historical processes, and yet reshaped its notion of period by a handful of brilliant institutions. It is not to be expected that show expert and professional an observer of poetry should allow his achievement to be more nearly classified than this. His comments on the nature of poetic drama and the relation between poetry and drama have done much to bring about a revival of poetic drama in the modern age. There is hardly any critic now who does not bear the stamp of his influence. Even if he had written no poetry, he would have made his mark as a distinguished and subtle critic. And friends, in this way we come to the end of this long chapter, 20th Century Criticism, T.S. Eliot.